is the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. Tom is still out. He will be back tomorrow, but me and Shano are sitting in today, one last day before Tom's back. The parents are still out, so we can play, have some anything goes, and lots of great, great guests, including, first up, Maya Shenhwar, editor-in-chief over at truthout.org and author of the new book, Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. Maya, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
There's a new piece in the New York Times today, basically rethinking it. In a safer age, U.S. rethinks its tough-on-crime system. Everybody from President Obama to the Koch brothers to Rand Paul to many of us progressives, as I would like to claim, recognize the massive problem we have with incarceration, the huge numbers, massive increase. But when we talk about solutions, all of a sudden people stop agreeing. When progressives like us talk about getting people out of prison, shortening sentences, conservatives say, hang on a second. How do we convince people that prison isn't this fantastic idea, isn't responsible for today's lower crime rates?
Well, I think there are a number of factors. One is that when you first look at the numbers, a lot of people jump to the conclusion that crime has actually been reduced because of mass incarceration, but really there's sort of a correlation there, but it's not at all a causation. And in fact, it's been shown that prison can actually be criminogenic. That means that actually increasing prison populations can increase violence. And that's for a number of reasons. We've also seen over the past few years that the states that have reduced prison populations the most have actually seen a larger reduction in crime than other states. So I think the first thing we have to do is really take down that myth of causation. I think another thing that we have to make sure is clear is that as these conservatives start coming forward questioning mass incarceration, sometimes even suggesting that we need fewer people in prison, as the Koch brothers have started doing, strangely enough.
Yeah.
Sometimes the solutions they're proposing are actually also harmful, such as increasing policing and zeroing in on what they call crime hotspots, which are usually poor neighborhoods of color where police are already a violent and aggressive presence.
See, already you've made me realize one of the flaws in my own line of thought. And this article, it credits some of New York City's crime reductions in focusing on these hotspots. Now that you say it's the poorer areas, it makes perfect sense as to why those would be hotspots, why they often have higher levels of policing. You know, this is such a big issue. How do we understand both sides that in a city like New York, massive crime reduction since the 1990s, which was on its way there before crime reforms. But, you know, where we've seen this type of crime reduction, we've also seen many police abuses, power abuses, stop and frisk. How do we square that circle, if you will?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. One is looking at all the factors that have contributed to crime reduction that have nothing to do with police. One is considering that we have an aging population. That has definitely been a contributing factor. Some people say that reduced inflation rates have contributed. Also, we have to look at the fact that crime has actually been reduced on average throughout the world. Violent crime over the past couple of decades. So this is a larger trend. No one's really sure what's causing it. So we take that and then we also think about, well, what does broken windows policing do? The kind of policy that's become popular in New York. Well, it goes in and targets neighborhoods of color. It targets people for very, very small offenses. And so whether that's jumping a turnstile, stealing a pack of gum, these really, really tiny things, with the idea that, oh, well, when you go after everyone, then, you know, you'll be not only hopefully deterring people from doing larger things, but also just gathering up a big net of people and hopefully getting people off the streets who might be doing things wrong. And that's a really, really cruel way of preventing crime, to just think getting as many people off the streets and therefore in jail or prison as possible. And of course, when we say people in that situation, what we're talking about is people of color, poor people. And so I think that the amount of credit that has gone toward that policing, and also the amount of ignorance that's come along with that in terms of the problems that policing is causing. We talk about policing reducing violence, but in many neighborhoods, policing is violence.
Very, very well stated. I want to quickly remind everybody, we're speaking with Maya Shanwar, editor-in-chief of Truthout and author of the new book, Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. I think sometimes on the right, progressives like myself get accused of just wanting to shut down the prisons, that it's take the profit motive out of prisons, and we don't care if criminals end up on the street. I know I certainly don't feel that way, but how do we respond to that argument and show people like that the prison isn't always the answer, that it often is counterintuitive in the needs of society?
Right. I mean, I think that that question and that accusation comes along with the assumption that prison is actually effective at reducing violence. And as we've seen, when prison populations go down, often violent crime goes down along with it. But also we have to look at what prison does. Prison in itself, like policing, is violent. It traumatizes people. Also, isolating people from society, breaking their connections with their families, communities, the rest of humanity, that's actually something that prevents people from moving past violence if that's something they're involved in. And so I think that when we think about the specifics of what prison actually does, that logic starts to break down. And we can challenge those arguments from kind of an offensive standpoint instead of being defensive and saying, wait, that's not what I mean. You know, it's really about, okay, instead of assuming that if there's violence, prison, more violence is the answer, let's take a step back and look at what prison does.
Right. And I know I certainly am not saying I have all the answers here, but I'd say my opinion is that it is time to restart this conversation, that we're already dealing with 20-year-old policy, 20-plus-year policy on this tough-on-crime, three strikes, you're out, mandatory minimum sentences ideas, and we obviously see it's not working. Maya, your book is, if I'm stating correctly, also calling for a renewal, a restart of that conversation, correct?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I think that that conversation, I'm really grateful that it's starting to come to the fore more and more. I just hope that as it does, we keep questioning the principle of prison, what incarceration is built on, and what kinds of policies, particularly racist policies, it's perpetuating, instead of just thinking of kind of the conservative argument around money and maybe trimming edges here and there. Well, so we really have to keep that in the front of our mind.
It, absolutely. And reading your book is a great place for people to start and to consider these questions, which are sometimes hard questions to answer, especially if we've, been on the side of this discussion. Maya, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you so much.
Maya Shanwar.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Check out her new book, Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. Back with more right after this break. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Me and Shano sitting in today for Tom. And we were speaking just a moment ago with Maya Shanwar about prison systems. We wanted to continue this conversation and get into more of the details. So joining us now is Jeremy Travis, president of John Jay College of Criminal Justice, City University of New York, CUNY.edu. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Travis.
You're quite welcome. Nice to be with you.
We noticed two articles in the New York Times today, one about the U.S. rethinking its tough-on-crime stance, another about Rikers finally banning isolation for younger inmates, and it brought a lot of thought about this whole idea of how we deal with criminals, how we deal with violent offenders, and you have done a lot of research on this and the effectiveness of incarceration. How do we balance the test of keeping people safe and also ensure that people incarcerated are treated humanely?
Well, I think it's interesting that you point out both of those articles because we are going through a period of national reexamination of our criminal justice policies, and in particular, our incarceration policies. You know, why do we have so many people in prison, and how do we treat them when they're there? So the backdrop here is just to recall that we have been through a 40-year period where we have increasingly relied on prison as our response to crime, and we've more than quadrupled the per capita rate of incarceration in America, something we've never done before. So this is totally new in the American experience. We stand way outside of every other democracy in the Western world. We now have the highest rate of incarceration in the world. And we do this at a great cost. It costs lots of money, $80 billion, but it's also a cost to our democracy, to the families of people who are incarcerated. And perhaps the most profound sort of question that's now on the table is, why are we doing this? And do we need to do this to respond to crime? And the answer to that is no. We can respond to crime much more effectively, efficiently, parsimoniously, and we don't need to have this big prison system.
You know, in this discussion, both of these articles, that question that I gave you at the forefront seems to be the only one considered. How do we balance public safety and incarceration? And according to this research report that I believe you're a part of here, the growth of incarceration in the United States, exploring causes and consequences, those are not the only questions we should be asking in this discussion. Can you explain the viewpoints that you guys looked into here and why it's so important that we consider the proportionality, the citizenship, and these other factors in sentencing?
Mm-hmm. So the report you referenced was a report put out by the National Academy of Sciences April 30th last year. 20 scholars were convened by the National Academy, and I was privileged to be asked to chair the consensus panel. And we were asked to answer two questions. First, what are the causes of this quadrupling of the rate of incarceration? Why has this happened? And then what are the consequences? And the answer to the first question is blindingly simple, is that we have so many people in prison because we have chosen to have this reality. We, through our policy process, our legislative bodies, we elected politicians who said they would be tough on crime, and they have delivered. And they've delivered by putting many more people in prison. So the crime rate itself has not resulted in the increase in incarceration. So we now know, ironically, through better policing strategies and more effective interventions, we now know so much more than we did 50 years ago about how to respond to crime. But to use those tools, we also don't have to put so many people in prison. So that's the National Academy consensus about the evidence that has resulted of how we have put so many more people in prison. But you also raise another question, which is how should we treat people when they are in prison? And the other findings of this panel are very important, I think, for the country, which is, as a democracy, we should care about the well-being of people in prison. And instead, over this year period, we have the prison conditions have gotten worse. Prisons are much more crowded. There are fewer programs in prison. We use isolation or administrative segregation or punitive measures much more in prison than we have in the past. So the committee that I chair also called for to open up the discussion about what should our prisons look like. So the other article that you cited so coincidentally today on Rikers Island, here we have my city, but I'm proud to be a New Yorker, taking really a big leap forward to say that in its jails, it is not going to use administrative segregation for people under 21. That is just inappropriate. So I think we're at a turning point where we're starting to ask some very profound questions about punishment in America.
Yeah, I think that's perfectly stated. In both reference to the Rikers story and this subject in a broader sense, you're quoted in this New York Times piece, and it's an excellent statement. The policy decisions to make long sentences longer and impose mandatory minimums have had minimal effect on crime. The research on this is quite clear. In your research, didn't this point come up? This harsher sentences, harder punishments, tougher on crime stance doesn't actually lead to making us safer.
Well, the National Academy report summarizes existing research. So what you just cited, unfortunately, has been known for a long time. That if you put somebody in prison and you say you're going to be in prison now 5 years longer than you already were going to be in prison, from 10 years to 15 years, from age 50 to 55, what the research has always shown is that those additional 5 years don't get you any public safety benefit.
Yeah.
Because people age out of crime and there's no additional deterrent value. The research has also shown for decades now that mandatory minimums, telling judges that they must put somebody in prison for a short period of time instead of sanctioning them in the community with a program that might actually address some of their behavioral concerns, but that also gets very little public safety benefit. And those are two of the three drivers of the increase in incarceration. And the third is the war on drugs.
Yeah.
And here the research is also very clear that putting people in prison, you know, we do this in New York State through the Rockefeller drug laws, for lifetime sentences for very small amounts of, for selling very small amounts of drugs.
One moment, Mr. Travis.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Excellent information, so well stated. Thank you so much. Jeremy Travis, President, John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Obviously, Tom is still out today. Shano and
he'll be
me.
Back tomorrow, though.
Yes, he will. Shano and me are filling in today. If you want to get in touch with us, feel free to touch base over on Twitter at Danielle on Radio or at Producer Shano. And big thanks to Maya Shenmar and Jeremy Travis, excellent guests. And this prison and incarceration is such an important topic. And the two New York Times pieces certainly prompted the discussion.
And then as I'm looking at it today, that's what prompted our discussion. Well, it's not very often you have two articles on the front page about the very same thing. So, this is something we should talk about. And I started searching around the Koch brothers. There's just an article yesterday about how the Koch brothers are putting together some groups you wouldn't normally put together. The ACLU and ALEC, of all things, to work on this. And so, there are those types of issues where partisan lines can fade away and we actually can get something done. I think this is one of them.
Yeah, I think so, too. And there's a lot. It's the what we get done part that worries me.
Sure.
And I have to admit, although I completely credit the Koch brothers, if they're really in this for the good of it, I'm a little skeptical.
Yeah, your skepticism is well-founded.
Well, and, you have two quotes in this New York Times piece, one from Senator Dick Durbin. It's time to step back and figure out what this dramatic increase in incarceration was and whether it was warranted. And then right across the aisle from Chuck Grassley saying, he realizes that incarceration is a problem, but he has across the board opposed any restrictions in sentences.
Well, the thing
so
is,
how do you
the fundamental problem at the start of the conversation is to decouple the falling rates in crime,
yes,
from the mass incarceration. One was not caused by the other. As Maya pointed out, there is a correlation, not a causation. Canada had the exact same drop off in crime over the same period, had none of these policies. None of these policies that took, essentially what these mandatory minimums did is conservatives are very, they don't like judges having a whole lot of discretion in these cases. You've seen the Bill O'Reillys of the world banging their chest when some judge gives a very low sentence.
Legislating from the bench.
Right. They took away the discretion from a judge. A judge has a defendant in front of them, knows the case, has been there for the trial, knows the individual, knows what has happened in their life, can assess that individual on a personal basis as to, all of the things that are necessary to fulfill the needs of justice. And that decision as to how long or what punishment to give was taken away. That discretion was taken away, saying, and a list was put together. If you are convicted of this, then it's this many years. If you're convicted of this, it's this many years. In some cases, it's a range. And for that reason, and they were very high ones.
Right.
So you end up with more people in prison. And as we found out, you know, from our past two guests, is more time in prison doesn't necessarily mean more safety.
Right. And it certainly doesn't mean better members of society after these people finally get out, if they ever get out of this cycle of incarceration.
Right.
Yeah.
Ralph Nader has pointed out all these areas where we can come together across the political spectrum and fix something. I think that conversation has started. And we'd love everyone's thoughts on this.
Right. And there is a ton of people already who want to weigh in on this. And I'm going to get you in just 1 second. We just want to let everybody know that since it's the last day before Tom gets back, we are going to also do Anything Goes. So if
sure.
there's something else you want to talk about, feel free to give us a call, 202-536-3270.
It's our last chance to talk about anything.
Exactly. And we have a lot of great guests still coming up today. Ian Millhiser, Brad Friedman, all kinds of good stuff. So, and it won't take away your one call a week per
yeah.
our normal call screening rules.
Yeah.
Say, you know,
I talked to the call screener. She said she's going to ease up on that this week.
You put in a good word?
I put in a good
okay.
word.
Okay. So we,
because
we
I mean, you're not, the gatekeeper. We know that rule.
We will not hold you to. You won't give up your one time to talk to Tom a week, by talking to us. So
oh, that would not be nice.
And if the number's busy, please call back because there are a lot of people on hold right now. So we're going to go. Let's start off with Chris, listening on Sirius in Ayer, Massachusetts.
Yeah, Ayer, but,
Ayer.
Yeah, I'm just calling. I think it's kind of funny that you pointed out that conservatives don't want even judges using their own good judgment, right? But,
yes.
But, I was going to say that one of the things that mass incarceration is a result of is Thatcherism and Reaganomics and trickle down economics.
Mm.
When you cut those programs, what you do is eliminate opportunities for education. You eliminate opportunities for advancement and transition. And this forces people in low-income positions to find opportunistic, you know, positions to be in. And, of course, the most open market is the black market.
Right.
So by taking away economic and educational opportunity, what you do is force people into a position where they're now in the legal crosshairs.
Yep.
And, again, now incarceration has replaced our social programs since Reagan as an answer for poverty.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important to note that our economic policy plays a direct role, which is why incarceration goes up, even though the crime rate goes down.
Yeah, right? I think excellently stated, Chris. And it's often a cycle because a lot of these start with, you know, a small crime. Then you have to pay court costs. When you don't have those mm-hmm. court costs, you end up with a warrant out for your arrest. And all of a sudden, not having that money because of all of the factors you just mentioned can result in a lot longer sentence.
Well, I'm a small business owner who doesn't listen to both sides.
And, you know, oh, I wish I had Stephanie Miller's gling for that.
You know, but I don't listen to both sides, and I have to hire people on a daily basis. And we do a background check because we're in people's homes, and violent offenders or robberies, we have to turn away, sex crimes.
Mm-hmm.
We purposely hire nonviolent offenders to give them an opportunity. And I wonder how many, you know, how many, there's also this stigma that goes with it where
sure.
these entrepreneurs, and I'll diverge into this for a second, if you will. It's still a plantation mentality, right? When the slave learned and taught himself to read, he was killed,
right?
Right? So anybody who chose to better himself in the plantation system was eliminated. And effectively, by putting these laws in place, you take people who want to have opportunistic abilities and entrepreneurial, you know, spirit, and you make their only opportunity illegal because they're not allowed to better themselves. You're going to have to accept your station. You're going to have to accept the poverty and living in a slum and a liquor store on every corner. And that's all there is to it, you know. And so I think there's a deep-rooted history of economic philosophy that's really just transitioned in its language but effectively remains the same. They take the people who are the most ambitious, the people who are most driven, make what they do illegal, right? And then put them in jail, and then they have no opportunity because when they go in for a real job, it's, oh, you're a felon, you know?
It,
so there's consequences for a long time.
Yeah, it is very interrelated with economics.
Absolutely brilliant.
But absolutely brilliant, Chris. Thank you very much for listening on Sirius.
It's great there.
In Massachusetts.
Along with this conversation about reforming prisons, we're also seeing businesses, like he was just talking about, actually actively seeking out, of course, nonviolent offenders. There was just a story recently about a food truck down in New York City who was doing the exact same thing. You know, I think that's a great thing. Trying to remove that stigma, actually given an opportunity instead of making it this, you know, this cycle.
I challenge other business owners to be like Chris in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And you know, hey, especially you self-identified libertarians, you know, a lot of these crimes are nonviolent drug-related crimes that, based on the libertarian view of the world, somebody should not have, you know, gone to prison and suffered ill from. So give them a job. If you're a business owner, you know, go out of your way like
that
Chris does.
That is the biggest thing that will break the cycle of imprisonment.
Yes, it really will.
That is the number one thing. Putting someone in prison is not going to do it. That's going to generally lead to more violence and more desperation and more of the disconnect from society itself. Having a job on the way out, that is the way.
Right. And these are a lot of the suggestions that Maya talks about in her book, that the report Jeremy Travis worked on, considers and weighs in on, that there are solutions to problems like crime besides just locking everybody away in jail. Yep. You know, that there are answers.
Yep.
Do we have time?
You do.
All right. Let's go with, Wayne listening in Chicago on WCPT. How's it going, Wayne?
Hey, how are you, Danielle? I just want to compliment you on the fantastic job you do serving for Tom.
Oh, you guys are too nice. You're nice to me just because I talk to you on the phone all the time.
But anyway, I wanted to kind of expound a little bit on what Richard Esgal was talking about yesterday. By the way, he has a great, fantastic show.
The Zero Hour, people could check out over at We Act Radio.
Yeah, I listen to it every week. But anyway, I'm going to break it down sort of like this. Okay, I'm a politician, and I call myself a Republican. But in actuality...
Wayne, we got like 30 seconds, so...
We can hold Wayne over.
We can hold you over, but otherwise you're going to have to hurry.
Okay. In actuality, I represent 5 to 10% of my district, but I want 100% of the people to vote for me. But in actuality, I represent the national and the international corporations. So in order for people to vote for me, I have to keep them divided. I have to make them think that Social Security is contributing to the deficit, which is not at all.
The case.
I have to do.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wayne, I don't know if we're losing you here. I'm going to put you on hold, Wayne, and we'll check in with you during the break. Hang on.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So do you think it's time for us to get rid of this tough-on-crime stance? Is there a better solution? What would it be? And welcome back to the Tom Hartman program. Wayne, if you can hear me, we will get back to you after this Free Speech TV break.
Because he's WCPT.
Yes.
Oh, by the way, Zero Hour is on WCPT as well. That's probably where Wayne listens.
RJ Esgal, I'm sure a little search of the DuckDuckGo or Google machine, and you can probably find a place to listen to it near you. But let's check in with Tom in Hagerstown, Maryland, watching on Free Speech TV. I'm intrigued by the comment here in the phone system, Tom. Superman versus Batman?
Well, yeah, I was listening to your show, and it reminded me of an interview with Frank Miller. And he was talking about the issue where he put Superman and Batman in conflict, and he was saying, Superman sees the world where crime is an aberration. And if it can be contained, then we kind of have peace and harmony. Whereas Batman sees the world as on the brink of chaos at all times, that our natural state is the criminal. And if it is not contained, then the veneer of civilization is shredded, then we fall into crime, we fall into what you see. And so Batman is more conservative, Superman is more liberal, but if you look at either of them, what is going to shred that veneer of civilization? So taking someone who's 15, 16, 18 and putting them 20 years in prison, or investing in that person, if you see what I'm saying.
I think I see what you're saying. It's certainly an interesting take on the whole discussion. I am not well-versed enough in comics to probably keep it in that argument or that frame for discussion. But, you know, viewing of whether we our natural state is chaos and crime or whether it's not and how we hang on to...
That's the thing I think we first have to answer is, do we view crime as a natural thing or as an aberration? You know, what do we really think of the human being?
I will certainly have to think on that. I don't think I can respond to
that. Tom talks about that a lot, that conservatives often have the notion that man is necessarily is generally bad, that there are evil intentions, and therefore you need this, you know, one person to guide over you and tell you how to live, how to be out of that. Whereas the more liberal view, and I'm being really broad in general, so I don't want to offend any conservatives out there by saying that, but this is the general, you know, old, hundreds-year-old debate, whereas liberals see man as generally good and able to govern themselves and to make their own decisions and don't need that ruler to tell them how to live their lives and conduct themselves in order to have a society that works. So
I'm actually more conservative in that. I personally view us as basically every single one of us as jumped up chimps who are born with the opportunity to become human.
Go ahead.
And, but I think you need to pursue policies then that encourage that becoming, not
so,
just assume, well,
but regardless of whether you look at it the way you're talking about, Tom, or maybe I would say I'm probably closer to the other side that I think people are inherently good. The question is, how do we motivate people to act accordingly, if you will? I think incentive as opposed to punishment.
Sure.
You know, the good reward is...
Or investing.
Right.
Put more people in college than in prison.
Right. I think it can be really effective. So, but really... supremely interesting line of thought there, and I'm sure we're going to get some more comments on it. Thank you for watching Free Speech TV. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Me, Danielle, and Shano, sitting in for Tom today for one last day. He'll be back tomorrow. And before the break, we were talking to Wayne in Chicago. And Wayne, I probably took your call a little closer to the break than I should have, so you didn't get a chance to make your point. So you were saying conservatives and Social Security. I apologize, I don't recall the rest.
Okay. Yeah, what I was saying was I'm making myself a Republican politician, U.S. Republican Congress.
You're putting your Republican hat on.
Right.
Okay.
I'm a congressman. So in actuality, I represent the national and the transnational corporations. That's the reality. So I represent 5 or 10% of the people who live in my district at the most. But the other 90%, I still want them to vote for me. But I also have to keep them divided, because if they realize what I'm doing, if they realize that I voted against like 300 pieces of legislation for environmental protection for them, if they realize that I voted for to gut Dodd-Frank, which means that not only can banks use my money that I deposit in their bank to play casino with Wall Street, but if the bank goes belly up, I don't even get my money back.
Right. I mean, Wayne, I think divide and conquer is probably the oldest.
Yeah. Scott Walker said it right out loud when it came to dealing with unions.
But so did Sun Tzu.
Sure.
You know, it goes back a little ways.
The art of war.
Yeah. It is an effective strategy, and that's why they use it. But we're actually going to get into this topic today about Democratic messaging.
Mm.
And it's something... I'm very interested in, and I know a lot of people listening are interested in how we counter message, that we stop letting the Republicans divide and control. It's kind of been a tangential topic all week in many of the other things we've talked about. So it's something we're going to get calls on. And I imagine, Wayne, you'll have some thoughts, and maybe we'll hear from you, Friday for Anything Goes or something. Right. But I'm going to get to some other calls, Wayne, but thank you very much, and thanks for listening on WCPT and for hanging out with us. But did you have
Nope.
Oh, I thought Shane was about to say something. Okay, just a deep breath.
Yeah, that's
just exasperation with me never taking a breather.
No, you're good.
Mike in Palmer, Alaska, watching on the DirecTV, you had some thoughts on the prison industry.
Yes, I do. People seem to forget that the prison industry, industry is actually the right word because it's prison for profit now in every state in the union. GEO, the company GEO, and there's another company, I cannot recall the name of it, they have, you know.
Is it CCA, Corrections Corporations of America?
Yeah. They are receiving oodles of money to house these prisoners. And what are they doing with the money? They're lining the pockets of their shareholders, because their main purpose in as a corporation is to take care of the shareholder. So how do we solve this? We go back to the policymakers and we investigate their holdings in said prison systems. If they're making money, that's a conflict of interest. And that's about all I got to say about it.
Excellent.
I feel that putting violent prisoners in prison, what did Cuba do back in the 1980s in the boat lift? They emptied all their damn prisons and gave us all their criminals. Think about it. That was the truth of the matter. He opened all his prisons. So, gee, we can't do that, though, because we're supposed to be a...
Yeah, Mike, I certainly think that the prison privatization of prisons is an issue, as well as starting that prison pipeline earlier and earlier now, all the way, you know, going into high school and middle schools. But thank you for watching on DirecTV up there in Alaska.
Yeah, there's four. This is, I learned long, long ago in like a first year law school class, Crim 101 or whatever it was. There's generally the theory is that behind incarcerations, there's four reasons for it: rehabilitation, retribution, pure old vengeance, deterrence, and public safety. And what we're hearing from this conversation here is, one, it doesn't help public safety.
Right.
Because our prisons are so violent. Two, because it is a for-profit industry in a lot of areas now, rehabilitation is being cut back on. So therefore, we're getting more violent people coming back out. So we've gotten rid of rehabilitation. We've gotten rid of public safety. Eventually, we're just down to vengeance and money is the only reason we're keeping these prisons around.
Yeah. I mean, to get back at people, and because it's easier for lawmakers, for a society, to simply push that which is difficult to answer off of their plate.
Sure.
So it's hard to answer questions about how we deal with, you know, poverty and jobs and education. Those are hard policy questions that's why they make the big bucks. Joke.
Allegedly.
Complete joke. At least on their paychecks.
Yeah.
But it's so much easier to just lock them away, throw away the key, and forget about them as if they're not human beings. And that's what we've been doing. That's why prisons in the past few decades have gone from 200,000 people to 1.5 million, I believe.
Yeah,
1.5 million on any given day. And that's as of 2009. So it's probably even higher.
And crime is going down.
Right.
It doesn't make sense.
Right. Right. It's incongruent.
So we have time for another.
Do we have time for one more? All right.
One more.
Let's go with real quickly, Brenda in Sepulpa, Oklahoma, watching on Dish Network.
Hi. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay. I hate to just be on blast like that, but listen, I've been incarcerated twice. I suffer from a mental illness. I'm not a violent person. I've never had a violent crime. There are people who are locked up in the jails. I'm not saying prisons, in the jails. I don't know how much they get a day. They get a lot of money a day, but they put you in there just as in general population for 23-hour a day lockup, and sometimes it's 24 hours for maybe 4 days, and you don't get to go out of your cell. This is a very small cell, and this is why you're waiting trial to go to prison or to go to back out in the streets.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, you know, there are people mentally ill, like, you know, my medication got off, and so they had to, you know, my cellies were like, get her out of here. She's lost her mind. You know, so they took me to someplace, you know, in maximum, it's up with max.
Brenda, I don't mean to cut you off, but we are out of time. But what you're saying is absolutely true, and you brought up an important point that a lot of times these aren't people who are even convicted. They're just waiting to go to trial.
And that our prisons have become the alternative to mental health care.
Yeah. It's a bad system.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Shano and me, Danielle, are sitting in for Tom today. Shano and I, as he's corrected me. It sounds so unnatural to say that.
I could be wrong, too.
Yeah. But filling in for Tom today, covering all sorts of interesting issues. And one more that we're bringing up today, awfully big issue, is a case coming up before the Supreme Court in March that could decide, many of us remember, whether or not states that did not set up their own Obamacare exchange will continue to get federal subsidies, or rather the individuals living in there. Ian Millhiser, constitutional policy analyst at the Center for American Progress, justice editor at thinkprogress.org, and author of a book you can also get in March, Injustices, the Supreme Court's nearly unbroken history of comforting the comfortable and afflicting the afflicted. Ian, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's great to be back. Thank you so much.
So I have to ask, I think most people listening are probably familiar with this Supreme Court case. It's been all throughout the news. But crazy question, can't believe I'm asking this. Did Scott Walker just save Obamacare?
He might have. I mean, the question is whether the Supreme Court is actually interested in following the law in this case. So what happened here? You know, again, the theory in this case is the plaintiffs want the Supreme Court to misread the Affordable Care Act. So it says that people who live in states where the federal government runs the health exchange don't get credits to help them pay for their insurance, while people who run in states that have state-run exchanges do. That's their whole theory of the case. And we dug up this video of Scott Walker in 2003. He was asked whether he was going to set up an exchange in his state or whether he was going to let the federal government do it for him. He said he would let the federal government do it for him. And these are Scott Walker's words, not mine. Scott Walker said he spent 2 years studying the issue. And after 2 years of careful study of the law, what he found is there is no real substantive difference between a federal exchange or a state exchange. That's his words. There's no difference between the two exchanges. This guy spent 2 years looking at the law. He had every incentive, because we know Scott Walker hates Obama and he hates Obamacare, to want to destroy the law. And what he found was that the plainest theory in what is probably the single most important lawsuit pending in front of the Supreme Court right now is utter garbage.
I am so not surprised that there is a conservative claim in front of the Supreme Court that could be labeled as garbage. It's so different than we've seen in previous years. Yeah. Quickly remind everybody, we're speaking with the one and only Ian Millhiser, constitutional policy analyst at Center for American Progress. So for people listening who, you know, aren't really law gurus, why would it matter that Scott Walker said this, that it doesn't matter the difference between a state and a federal exchange? Should the Supreme Court care? Will they care? Why does this matter?
Sure. So it matters for two reasons. I mean, one reason it matters is that if a law is unclear, the normal rule is that the courts defer to the federal government's interpretation of the law. And so the fact that Scott Walker read this law and wasn't able to find the plaintiff's interpretation in there suggests that at the very least the law isn't clear that the plaintiffs are right. And again, if the law isn't clear that the plaintiffs are right, then the plaintiffs lose. But more than that, you know, what the court has said in the past is they have said that in cases like these where someone is claiming that federal money is made conditional upon the states taking a particular action, the court pays particular attention to what state officials' perspective in those cases. They see whether the state officials would have understood that the law creates that kind of conditional relationship where people only get something if the state also does something. And if the state officials couldn't figure out that that was the deal, then the Supreme Court says, well, then it wasn't a conditional arrangement. If the states can't figure out that they could be costing their citizens billions of dollars, we're not going to take that money away from them because the state officials weren't able to even figure it out by reading the law. And so what Walker is admitting here is he is admitting that, look, I looked at this thing. I think it says what Barack Obama thinks it says. And if I think it says what Barack Obama means, it says, how could I possibly have known that I was going to be taking all of this money away from my citizens? If the Supreme Court follows the law, the plaintiffs are going to lose. Everyone gets to keep their health care.
Now, that's first and foremost a big if. But based on this premise, this, that if taking the money was conditional, right. It seems like Scott Walker wasn't alone in missing the point of those conditions, missing that requirement. You have quotes here in your article up over at thinkprogress.org from Nebraska Governor Dave Heineman, former Virginia governor, formerly not incarcerated Bob McDonnell, that neither of them obviously picked up on the fact that there were conditions to this money as well.
That's right. You know, Heineman's a Republican. He said, and this is his words, on the key issues, there is no real operational difference between a federal exchange and a state exchange. McDonald said that there is no evidence of any clear benefit to a state-run exchange as opposed to a federal exchange. And I'll add that because it seems like I'm going to be dealing with cases trying to kill Obamacare in the Supreme Court for the rest of my life, you know, I can't wait to see what they file in 2052. But the last time we were worried that the Supreme Court was going to kill the law, 24 states filed a brief where they said that Obamacare can only operate in the manner that Congress intended if those tax credits are kept intact. Again, these are 24 states that were actively trying to destroy the law, and they said that the only way it can work the way that Congress wanted it to work is if we make sure that everyone in all 50 states gets those tax credits. So, how can you possibly conclude that the only possible reading of the law is this crazy theory that the plaintiffs have come up with when you've got all of these Republican governors and attorneys general who are in the process of trying to kill the law, saying, oh, and by the way, that thing that lawsuit is saying that's trying to kill it, that's ridiculous.
Well, and we're talking about some pretty big impact. If the Supreme Court, as it has in the past, ignores precedent, ignores, set law, and decides to do what it wants anyway. According to your post, just earlier this week, 8 million people, is that a serious number? 8 million people stand to lose subsidies if the Supreme Court rules in favor of the plaintiffs?
I mean, not just subsidies. 8 million people stand to lose insurance altogether. And that's actually the optimistic prediction.
Wow.
The pessimistic prediction is what happens when, if you take subsidies away, is premiums go up for everyone, or almost everyone. Healthy people may decide they can't afford their premiums. And if healthy people can't afford their premiums, they drop out of the healthcare market, and the insurance companies don't have enough revenue left over to cover their sick patients. So what do they have to do? They got to raise premiums even more, which causes even more healthy people to drop out. This is called a death spiral, where higher premiums beget fewer customers, which leads to higher premiums, which leads to fewer customers, until eventually the entire market collapses and literally no one has health insurance.
It really is a scary concept. Now, I am not a legal expert like you, like Shano, but isn't there some type of, and we only have a quick, you know, less than a minute here, but isn't there some precedent that just says when 8 million people are affected, you can't change the law?
I mean, you would think that, you know, they would be really reluctant to do this. Look, the law does what it does. And if the law actually said what the plaintiffs say it says, then people would be in a world of hurt because judges should follow the law. The problem is what this case is really about. It is a case about whether or not the Supreme Court is capable of reading three sentences. The plaintiffs literally, they pick seven words out of the law. They say, just read these seven words. Don't read anything else. And if you just read those seven words and you squint, it seems like the plaintiffs are right. If you read the whole statute,
right?
It puts it in context.
Sorry, quick second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Ian Millhiser, you get smarter every time you listen to him. Constitutional policy analyst and author of the new book, Injustices. Go pick it up today. And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Free Speech TV break. Is Ian sticking around?
He is.
Oh, we get more Ian, so I will go right back to him. Ian Millhiser, you are sticking with us. You couldn't get enough.
How could anyone get enough?
I could easily say the same to you. This case is such a big case, as so many before the Supreme Court are. And you've broken it down so brilliantly. When it first came out, it seemed like this was a lot of honest argument back and forth, that both people kind of had some valid points. It doesn't seem that way anymore after reading your fine work over at Think Progress.
No, I mean, I appreciate it. I mean, you know, the law is hard sometimes. You know, the law is hard. Sometimes statutes are complicated. Sometimes you read a law and you have to spend some time cross-referencing things. And I think the genius of the plaintiff's legal theory in this case is they figured out a way that they can say in one sentence, here's why we think we should win. And, you know, that last segment I did with you, that was a lot longer than one sentence. You know, it takes me some time to explain a legal argument because I am a responsible lawyer who doesn't make things up. But, the fact that it takes some time doesn't mean that there isn't a clear answer. And in this case, you know, there is a very clear answer.
Yeah, it seems pretty cut and dry to me. How do we break this down, this case, into more than just a talking point, more than when we're faced with our conservative family members and friends who want to just continue to drive home that states that didn't set up their own exchange shouldn't get subsidies? What's the easiest way to respond to that argument?
Sure. So, I mean, here's like the quickest legal argument for, you know, explaining why the law doesn't say what the people trying to kill Obamacare says it says. The language that they rely on, there's a provision that refers to an exchange established by the state. That's the provision that calculates how much of a tax credit people get. And so they claim that if you just read that one provision in isolation, it says that if you aren't in an exchange established by the state, your tax credit is zero. That's their legal argument. The problem is there's another provision of the law. You know, again, you got to be able to read three sentences here. If you read the other provision of the law, that provision says that any exchange, regardless of whether or not it is established by the state government, the federal government, or whoever, shall be deemed to be an exchange established by the state. So that it shall be an exchange established by the state. And so, you know, you have one law saying, you have one provision that says you only get this money if you're in an exchange established by the state. You have another provision that says any exchange, even if the federal government sets it up, shall be an exchange established by the state. That might be an annoyingly complex way to draft a law, but that's why they pay me the big bucks. And that's why, you know, that's what lawyers do, is they sometimes read complicated passages and figure out what they mean. And in this case, the meaning is clear.
Yeah. Well, there is a lot more questions I have for this issue. So hopefully you're going to continue through one more segment with us.
Sure, I can do another.
All right. We are still just a few more minutes with Ian Millhiser, and then we're going to go right back to your calls. So don't go anywhere. Tom Hartman Program, me and Shano filling in. Stick around. Back to the Tom Hartman program. Still, me and Shano sitting in for Tom today, and we have a few more minutes that we stole here with Ian Millhiser, constitutional policy analyst for Center for American Progress and author of the amazing new book, Injustices, the Supreme Court's Nearly Unbroken History of Comforting the Comforted, Comfortable, and Afflicting the Afflicted. That's quite a title, by the way, Ian.
It is. We actually shortened it. We took the nearly unbroken words out because my publisher told me it was too long.
Yes, but it's a challenge to see who's really paying attention when we read it. How fast can they type that into the search engine so they can go out and buy a copy of Ian Millhiser's new book?
I appreciate it. Just Google my name and injustices, and it should come up.
Sounds good. We are continuing our discussion about this very big case coming up before the Supreme Court that will be here before we know it. And I had a couple more questions for you. First one being, what's to stop states from just declaring that their federally run exchange is a state exchange? I believe we've seen a couple states do this, to just pass a one-sentence law and say that our exchange is hereby known as a state exchange.
Right. So the answer to that is we don't know. And the reason we don't know is because what the Supreme Court would do if they rule against the tax credits here, if they rule against Obamacare here, is they would essentially be rewriting the law to say something that it doesn't say. And so normally when you're trying to answer a question like, okay, does something count as a state exchange or a federal exchange, you look at the text of the law and you see how it defines the difference between a state and a federal exchange. Well, this law says they're the same thing. So if the Supreme Court rewrites the law to say something it doesn't say, I can't predict where they're going to draw the line and what they're going to say counts as state and what they're going to say counts as federal. That said, I think there's a bigger problem to worry about here. I mean, there might be some states that find a way, that currently have federal exchanges, that find a way to convert them into state exchanges. But here's the problem. Texas is part of the United States, too. You know, so is South Carolina, so is Louisiana, and I'm of the radical belief that if you live in a red state, you don't deserve to die because you can't afford your health care.
Yeah, how radical of you, Ian. Why could you even think such a thing?
Exactly. And that's what's frightening about this case, is that Texas lives matter, too, and we know that there are states, because of the politics in those states, that are going to do everything they can to thwart Obamacare. And that means that no matter what happens at the state level, that, you know, there are states that could find them on a map for you, that we know if the Supreme Court does the wrong thing here, they will use it as an excuse to take health care away from people.
You know, and Supreme Court and excuse brings up another interesting question. We've seen, especially in the past few years, the Supreme Court take cases that mm-hmm. maybe were questionable they should have even taken, and then ruled in ways that were somewhat unprecedented, not sticking to the case in controversy, not keeping a ruling to the issue at hand. They've gone some leaps and bounds in interesting directions. Is this case, this Affordable Act case, really just the conservative justices trying to take another shot at Obamacare? Did they take this just, you know, law be damned, don't care what the precedent is, just as an opportunity to strike down Obamacare?
Well, so here's what scares me is, like, you know, and this isn't just a shameless opportunity to plug my book again. You know, Injustices looks at the last 150 years of Supreme Court history. And what I found was that throughout almost all of it, the Supreme Court was pretty terrible. You know, they stood with slavery and Dred Scott. They stood with segregation. They stood with Jim Crow. They stood with they struck down child labor laws. They stood with eugenics and said that women could be sterilized against their will. You know, the Warren Court, the point that we liberals tend to think of as like the golden age of the Supreme Court, it was an accident. The Warren Court happened in part because Eisenhower wanted to appoint two conservatives to the Supreme Court, and he didn't know what he was doing, and he appointed two liberals. He thought Earl Warren was a conservative.
I did not know that story, and I will absolutely have to pick your brain on that and learn more. And I bet I can read it and injustices.
Yeah, indeed you can. So my point is, I mean, I think what the Roberts Court has, a lot of what they've done is terrible. And I think it would be, it is frankly a threat to the rule of law if they think they could rewrite the law the way that the plaintiffs in this King case are asking for Obamacare to be rewritten. But it's not like this is something new. You know, this is how the Supreme Court has acted throughout most of its history. And what I argue in my book is that if we do see, and, you know, in the past it's been even worse than it is now, if we do see the Supreme Court return to its worst days, that's not going to be some tremendous anomaly. That's just going to be Tuesday for most of the Supreme Court's history.
It's a scary precedent, especially granted we have had some great rulings. You know, DOMA comes to mind off the top of my head. We have had some really, you know, groundbreaking movements forward. But overall, it hasn't been the greatest recent history in Supreme Court case law, if I'm saying that correctly. It is a little scary, but based on the argument you've laid out here, you're giving me hope that that people in those red states won't lose their subsidies.
Yeah, I mean, it's a scary thing that could happen in this case. And, you know, what I'm really counting on is, like, you know, I don't think Chief Justice Roberts is a good guy, but I don't think that Chief Justice Roberts likes to look stupid. And, you know, and I'm serious about this. Like, you know, the plaintiff's legal argument in this case is so bad. And, like, he's just going to get destroyed. I mean, I can imagine the flames leaping off of Justice Ginsburg's dissent, if she has to dissent. And I am hopeful that at the end of the day, what's going to happen, you know, there's a phrase that former law clerks have. I had to do it when I clerked for a federal judge, where the judge says that he thinks that a case should come down one way. You're the law clerk. You start researching it. You sit down and try to write a case that way. And you do this awkward walk across the judge's chambers, and you walk into his office, and judges have huge offices. So it's like a huge walk to get to the other side of the office. And you look at the judge, and you sort of shyly say, "Judge, this opinion won't write."
This opinion won't write.
That's what I'm counting on to save Obamacare.
That dog won't hunt, I think, is the southern expression, the southern version of that. Ian Millhiser, brilliant as usual. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Ian Millhiser, constitutional policy analyst and the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
We have so much more in store, and it's still anything goes here on the Tom Hartman Program. What are your thoughts? Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Special thanks to Ian Millhiser of the Center for American Progress. He is so brilliant, I think my IQ goes up every time I talk to him.
And it's a fun interview to listen to, I have to say, as someone who is listening.
Well,
you know, constitutional law can be very boring, very dry and difficult.
Not when Ian talks about it.
Yeah, yeah. I feel smarter.
It makes me very intrigued about his new book, because if it's, you know, 300 pages of that, I literally can't wait to get my hands on it.
I love the story about that case won't write.
Yeah.
The same thing happens. Because I worked in law firms.
Yeah.
Where, you know, in law school, you learn, you know, you're given the issue and, you know, your client comes in and asks you what the answer is. And you go out and you, as the young lawyer, and you search it out and say, here's the answer. And then you go to a law firm and they don't ask you ever to do that. You have a partner who looks at you and says, I want a case that says this. I want a case that you go research and tell me I'm right. And then you inevitably, just like a judge saying, I want the case to turn out this way. Inevitably, there are those situations in which you go and do the research and say, you have to go back to the partner of the law firm and say, sorry, no.
Not going to happen.
No, this brief won't write.
Yeah.
Although I never used that phrase, but now I have it.
Yeah.
Now that it's completely useless to me because I work in radio, not in law
firm. Ian gave us a new phrase for the lexicon.
It is.
And
I'm
intrigued on what people think about, you know, the Affordable Care Act's challenge before the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court in general. We talked earlier this week about should Supreme Court justices have to reach a supermajority if they're going to rule on something that's a constitutional issue. Should they have to reach a supermajority if it's something that affects 8 million people? I'm just curious on what people think. And there's a lot of other stuff that I'm sure we'll never get to today. But
yeah, you programmed for a 6-hour show. When I saw the list, I'm like, what other show are we guest hosting for today, Danielle?
I was
But let's get the callers because they're far more interesting.
Yes. Let's check in with John in El Monte, California. John,
what are you doing?
The judicial system. John.
He doesn't need to get.
John.
I think John's talking to
John's
his kids.
not paying attention. So I'm going to put you back on hold, and we're actually going to go to a different John in Roseville, Michigan?
Michigan, yes.
I'm so bad at that. Michigan and Mississippi. Thanks for watching
Free Speech TV, Michigan.
John. Yeah. What are your thoughts? Thank you for watching the Tom Hartman program.
What is wrong with the Republicans is believe that they're paying homage to King Reagan.
I think that's a fair statement.
Maybe he was their god.
I think there's a, you know, Tom calls it, what is the great man theory of politics? And mm-hmm. I don't know if that's.
Yeah, I think so.
I think there's a pattern of a lot of people in politics kind of deifying one person or another. I've seen it done with Ted Kennedy, with JFK, and
FDR.
Yeah, FDR. And there's always reasons for us to love and honor and respect certain people. And on the Republican side, they can certainly feel that way about Reagan.
I think when it comes to deifying a human being, because we're all fallible,
yeah,
it requires forgetting a lot of what that person did.
It's certainly the case with Reagan.
It's certainly the case what has happened with Reagan is they've forgotten pretty much all of it in the Reagan Legacy Project.
Yeah. I mean, John, were you was this a specific issue that brought this to mind, or is this just in general?
No, it's just from, you know, I'm 60 years old. I know what Reagan did. And everybody must have thought he must have been the greatest person alive in the Republican Party. That's why they keep following his progress.
Yeah.
And
I hear you. Perhaps we should stop expecting one man to fix all our problems, and people on both sides should stop looking back to one person as having all the solutions.
Yeah.
Republicans. Reagan wasn't.
They foisted upon him this myth. You know, tear down this myth. Great book about
how
Reagan
book.
Isn't really what the Reagan Legacy Project wants us to believe he is. And perhaps actually, if they followed Reagan a little bit more, we'd be in better shape. You know, when it comes to dealing with our
immigration taxes.
The way that the economy got out of the recession, he tripled the national debt. So he did a little Keynesian economics there. It had nothing to do with tax cuts. You know, I'm not saying every single policy. He worked against nuclear proliferation.
Yeah. Hey, all good issues to strive for. Why don't we, John? Thank you very much for watching Free Speech TV there in Michigan, and we'll give the Ronald Reagan King theory some thought. Let's jump to Dave in Kansas City, watching on Free Speech TV as well. Dave, you had a question about Social Security.
Yeah, a while ago, Jim was talking about a disability change in 2016. They're going to cut disability. My question is that on future disability people or people that are currently on disability?
To my understanding, it would be all beneficiaries. It's essentially that the insurance program, the bank account with that money, wouldn't have enough to pay out all of the benefits for everybody, current and future. And unless they move some money from that other bank account, as they have 11 times before, they're going to subject disability recipients to some very serious cuts.
Well, yeah, that's what I was wondering. We were debating, so. It's everybody's going to be cut, huh?
As far as I know, I don't know that there is.
What we do know is that
policy released.
They're setting up. They're setting up a false crisis.
Right.
We do know that, and how they're going to use that crisis, I think we're getting wind of, is that now that we have a crisis, now it's time to quote unquote reform Social Security because the disability account is broke, and they want to create a false crisis so that they can have their hands on Social Security and do all these reforms that people have not wanted before, that the Congress has voted against when George Bush proposed it in his second term. They want to create this crisis, and this is the way they're doing it. They're attacking the disability account because they have projected the disability account, the way the money is funneled in there, that come 2016, there won't quite be enough money. What they have done in the past 11 other times is there's two Social Security accounts. There's the main one, and there's a disability account. There's plenty of money to shift some of the money in the main account over to the disability account as a stopgap measure, and everything would be fine. Disallowing that creates the false crisis, and it's a political maneuver. It's a political maneuver to put all options on the table, as they often like to say, and start a negotiation where I'm glad for Democrats who will not have that negotiation in the past. Bernie Sanders has said, no, we will not consider chain CPI. No, we will not consider cutting COLA and things like that. They want to open that conversation, because as soon as you open the conversation, then you have to compromise. And if you compromise, that means cuts. And cuts is something that we've fought against and will continue to fight against.
Right. And Democrats need to be getting on this message now. So that a year from now, when this crisis is on the brink, we don't have Republicans saying Democrats won't compromise and help keep, you know, disabled people from getting benefit cuts. We can't wait until then to have this conversation, because if we do, that's when that so-called compromise includes cuts, privatization, things that we've seen in the past, like, oh, you know, the compromise is $5 billion cut out of
practical effects, which I think you're asking about. If nothing is done, if this rule stays in place and no changes are made, then yes, it will result, I believe, in a 20% cut for current recipients of disability insurance payments under SSDI, if nothing is done. I don't believe that's the goal. I don't believe that's the process. I don't believe that's the politics they're playing.
And I don't believe that even the Democrats will let it get to that point.
Right, and that's what Republicans are banking on.
Right.
The Democrats won't, and therefore they'll give up something.
Exactly.
Right. It's the hostage they're taking.
Exactly.
It is the hostage they're taking in the crisis.
But, Dave, hopefully that answered your question.
Yes, it does. 20% is what they're
estimating.
Proposing, huh?
Yes.
They're estimating
that's
would be the
cut.
Effect. Yes.
Yeah, it's huge. It'll bankrupt me.
Well, hopefully it doesn't get to that point. And
that's why we're talking about it now, so it doesn't get there.
And a lot of people listening are fighting already. This only happened days ago, and lots of people are on it on this one, and we're not going to let it fall to the wayside. So thank you for watching on Free Speech TV and for listening there in Kansas City. And hopefully we can keep that from happening. Do we have time for one more?
We do.
All right. Let's go back to John and see if John is in El Monte, California on DirecTV. Are you there, John?
Actually, I'm in Riverside.
Oh, Riverside. Sorry, we do it by zip code. So if the zip code, maybe picks up the wrong city, just let us know and we'll correct that. But go ahead.
Yeah, I call them back on the judicial system.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a twice convicted felon charged with assault with a deadly weapon. I never put a scratch on anyone. And I also was acquitted of four counts, felonies. And they charged me with failure to appear and sentenced me to 4 years.
Even though you were acquitted, you were charged with failure to appear.
Right.
Yeah.
Because they were going to up my bail. I was already out on a bail bond.
See, those are the tricky ways that the judicial system keeps people in that cycle, you know, where you serve time, you did what you were supposed to, but get one.
Well, what happened is my ex was on crystal meth her whole life, so anytime she lied, I went to jail over it. So I spent most of the time protecting my kids. So I had an appellate court take it up because on a felony of violence, you're going to be doing 90% of your time. So they ended up setting me up with a 40-month sentence, and I sent it to an appellate court, and the appellate court overruled the first assault with a deadly weapon because I didn't have one.
Mm.
And they also attached a strike to the first case, which they removed the strike.
Mm.
And then they released me after 20 months. But in all, both felony cases should be overturned. I'm working on this right now because neither one of them were valid to begin with.
Right.
And to fight those difficult cases, those cases where you really didn't do it, you got to get bullied by the system, it costs a ton of money and a lot of time, like you were just talking about right there.
Yeah.
Those appeals are
it's
tough.
Not always as cut and dried as people think it is in the judicial system.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, what do you think of the judicial system, of the ACA? There are lots of topics today. And welcome back to the Tom Hartman program. Let's check in with Bruce in Atlanta, Georgia, watching on the Dish Network. Bruce, you had thoughts on net neutrality. I'm a little confused by what the question is here.
My question, what's up, Mr. Danielle, Mr. Shane, always good to hear y'all do this. I get two new perspectives on things.
Okay.
My question is, what exactly is the opponent's claim that net neutrality would stifle innovation? Well, actually, Mr. Javinsky's report said rules would stifle innovation. By that, I take it they mean net neutrality. How do they claim that that would somehow stifle innovation?
I think this is kind of the general argument that they say any regulation, any time the government gets involved, it will stifle innovation. And I've actually given this a lot of thought because it comes up so often. It didn't stifle innovation when it came to the internet before then. It didn't stifle innovation when it came to our cell phones. You know, there's lots of regulations, common carrier status on our phone carriers. So I don't understand why all of a sudden the government being involved in regulating is going to stop all innovation when it comes to the internet.
And also when it comes to innovation, there's a general conservative view that the only reason someone would ever innovate is if they can make oodles and oodles of money. We're talking monumentally mind-boggling amounts of money. And this is one way that if you do have an idea, you will make mind-boggling amounts of money, but only if you have a lot to begin with.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think, Bruce? Can't you think of examples of where the government has been involved and the government is regulated, but yet we still see businesses and private investors innovate and improve? Look at Tesla. Improve their own inventions, if you will.
Well, that's true. I haven't seen personally how innovation has been stifled. I agree with you there. That's why I was asking. It's like, what am I missing? Is it obvious? And I'm losing my ability to process incoming data all of a sudden? You know, it's like, what am I missing? And obviously, I'm not missing much of anything.
No.
Not that I could think of, Bruce. I think you've got it right on the money.
I think it's a knee-jerk reaction of conservatives. If you're going to regulate, it's bad. And
yes.
That, what do you plug in? Why is it bad? Because it's going to reduce innovation.
Exactly.
It's just kind of, that's the B you're going to get out.
And I think it's a bit of nonsense. But, Bruce, I really appreciate you watching there on the Dish Network in Atlanta. And thank you very much for calling. Do we have time for?
Oh, very quickly.
All right. Let's quickly switch to Cliff in Claremore, Oklahoma. Jail the banksters, one of my favorite topics.
Well, okay. First, I'm going to start out with distrust in whom the impulse to punish is powerful. I'm just quoting Nietzsche because basically that's what's happening with the people who are the average American is we're being punished for stuff that the rich want to go ahead and take from us. We don't have enough to take from anyways, but they're going to go ahead and take the crumbs as well. Okay. And personally, I think what they need to do if they want to solve this whole situation on crime is maybe put the big corporate CEOs on trial, just like they did with the mob back in the 60s and 70s, and perhaps maybe have an organized crime hearing right there, because if there's one thing that's organized crime, I think it's the corporations and the law to back them up. The mob didn't really have the law, unless it was, of course, paying off politicians.
Yeah, Cliff, I think you're right on, and I think people have even looked into using RICO laws to prosecute some of these banksters. I think it's a great idea. We'll be back with Ellen Ratner of the Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Tom is out. Just a reminder, he will be back tomorrow, but me and Shano and I are still sitting in for one more day, and we've got lots of great topics to talk about. Prison, Affordable Care Act, and Cliff in Oklahoma there during the break brought up jailing the banksters, always one of my favorite topics. But we do need to get to the news with Ellen Ratner of the Talk Radio News Service, free-don.org. Don Siegelman had an appeal yesterday.
He did, but I don't know that there been a ruling. I don't think there has. Yeah.
I was crossing my fingers that maybe we had some good news.
I love Governor Siegelman,
yes.
And I wish that the president would take some action on this, but
we will keep fighting.
Okay, speaking of keeping to fight, well, the House, now controlled, of course, it has always been controlled by Republicans in the recent past, but today they blocked funding for, or attempted to block funding for the president's immigration signature. And as you know, he had an executive order. So the overall measure passed 236 to 191 with 10 Republicans voting against it, two Democrats voting in favor. But there were two amendments that are of interest. One was defunding the president's entire initiative. That went 237 to 197. Republicans voted no. And then the arrival of children. Now, this is very interesting because, of course, they want to protect kids who got here before the age of 16. It went down 218 to 209. 26 Republicans voted with the Democrats on that one.
Wow. To actually protect the children coming across the border.
That's exactly correct. And so that is pretty interesting. And that means that there really is some movement in some of the Republican Party to protect people, or as somebody said, that this was very mean-spirited, the way that the legislation had been written. Okay. Now, the Voting Rights Act there was a press conference today by Chairman Goodlatte. He is now the new head of the House Judiciary Committee, and he was asked about whether he's going to let legislation come up around the Voting Rights Act. As you know, there was a Supreme Court case, and I'm getting some yes over there from our Supreme Court reporter, Shelby versus Holder. And it apparently gutted one of the biggest parts of this discrimination act. Well, today, Robert Goodlatte, Bob Goodlatte, said that Congress he's not going to take this up in his Judiciary Committee.
Wow. So they're Steny just Hoyer, fine without renewing the formula section of the vote.
Yes, and this is what, you know, it's been law of the land. What, Voting Rights Act was 1964. Right, exactly. Pretty amazing. Okay. Also, today, Rand Paul decided to leave Congress and go up because there's no votes. And he went up to New Hampshire, six places he visited in New Hampshire. And in one of them, he told a group of New Hampshire legislators that people on disability assistance were gaming the system and that over half the people on disabilities are anxious or have back pain. Join the club. Today, the Democratic Party in just an hour or two is going to give a conference call. They're going to have a registered nurse, the mother of an adult son with disabilities. She's going to be responding to Rand Paul.
For the last 3 days, we've had people calling in on this Social Security disability cut, the 20%, and explain their stories and what it would mean to them, people who police officers injured on the job, people who lost their sight after working for 10, 20 years as teachers. And I can see that there's four or five more people on the board right now.
Well, it'd be interesting to get them all and put it together in some, you know, 5-minute little video that I can put on our website and you can put on yours.
Maybe we can arrange that.
That would be great. So the president today is going to Cedar Falls. He's there right now. He is going to attend a fiber optic splicing demonstration, and then he's going to talk about how we can have affordable broadband. Now, what's so interesting is when broadband first sort of came into being in a major way, I remember the arguments in the Senate. The Republicans were saying, well, this should not be done by cities. This should only be done by the private sector, i.e. Verizon and, you know, all that, those types. Well, so they were objecting, and they wanted to limit a city's ability to do this. Now, the president is going out to a city, that Cedar Falls, Iowa, that has not limited it and that has wanting to make it very available to everybody because he knows that broadband is important. Now, where I am, work in South Sudan, we would love to have broadband, but the powers that be have stopped American companies from putting in broadband there. One can only suspect the reasons why. And that it has really stopped South Sudan, who now doesn't have the oil, from making the kind of progress that it needs to make.
I'm sure those two points have nothing whatsoever to do. No oil, no infrastructure, no broadband.
Exactly. So the president they put out a 5-point plan from the White House. And they want to unveil some grant opportunities for rural providers. They want to provide incentives for different municipalities to put this in, whether they do it with a private contract or public, et cetera.
It would be great for lots of reasons, including the infrastructure capabilities and jobs.
Yes. Now, I just want to go back to one thing because I didn't talk about it, and that is that Speaker Boehner today talked about the president's unilateral decision on immigration, and he then says 22 times President Obama said he did not have the authority to take unilateral action on immigration. He lists all the times from 2008 on. talking about.
Now,
all
how
that.
Could they block funding on an executive action? I understand they control the purse strings. I understand they're responsible for the financial aspect. But, you know, without cutting off entire government agencies, how on earth could they block that funding?
If I only knew, if I only knew. One other thing, Senator Ted Cruz today, as you know, Republican from Texas, he is now chair of the Senate Commerce Committee on Science, Space, and Competitiveness. Now, who would have think that he would really push NASA? Because that's something us, you know, crazy libs do, things like that. Well, don't forget, it's in Texas. So therefore, he is now back on racing to the moon and racing to space and pushing science
it
and pushing NAFTA.
It all makes sense now. It all makes sense. I just theorized that he might think that space was where God lives.
Space is where Texas lives.
Ellen Ratner of the Talk Radio News Service, free-don.org.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Shano and I are filling in for Tom today. And if you want to touch base with us, feel free to do so over on Twitter at Danielle on Radio or at Producer Shano. Give us your feedback. Let us know, you know, how horrible we are. That's totally cool.
Positive feedback.
Positive feedback would be welcome, too.
No, when I mean positive feedback, I mean you'd be positively better if you did this.
Yes.
Well, yesterday we weren't critical enough. To which I said, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
I honestly
think that's a fair criticism.
Not to be defensive here, but if you ever borrowed somebody's car.
I have.
And especially a valuable car. You don't drive like a maniac when you borrow somebody's car. We're still hosting the Tom Hartman program. Speaking of which, Tom will be back tomorrow.
Yes. And that's probably the best news listeners have had all day.
There they are. See, the phone lines are full now.
Speaking of somebody who could use some good news, Roger Ver, I think it's how it's pronounced, V-E-R, he previously, earlier last year, renounced his U.S. citizenship.
Okay.
See, he's one of these in the story over at addictinginfo.com from Left Wing Nation, the author. He is one of your, quote, typical freeloading libertarian millionaires.
Oh, so he was fleeing the taxes, the oppressive taxes of the United States and went to another country.
He loved all the fancy perks we got here in the United States, but he didn't want to pay any taxes for them. So in 2014, he renounced his citizenship and moved to the island St.
Croix?
Kitts? No. Kitts? I'm not sure. Not familiar with the place.
Jim says it's St. Kitts.
St. Kitts. Thank you, Jim. A tropical island with almost no taxes. However, he's very upset because now he can't come back.
Funny thing happens when you thumb your nose at the United States and say you want to leave. You don't get to come back.
By renouncing his U.S. citizenship, he has not been allowed back into the U.S. for speaking appointments. And the U.S. Embassy in Barbados has even refused to consider his evidence for an application. The official reasoning is that he has no ties to his home country,
right.
St. Kitts, so they have no reason to believe that he won't just stay here illegally.
Now, we talked about this a little bit earlier in the week, in that when California and Jerry Brown and everyone voted to increase taxes, and mm-hmm. they were yelling that the millionaires are going to leave. What's going to happen? And Sean Hannity trotted out a few, disgruntled millionaires. I wonder if Sean Hannity's going to bring this guy on.
Maybe
that's a way to get back in the country.
I am curious.
I have to appear on the Hannity program.
And I'm intrigued.
To talk about the fact that Ayn Rand was absolutely wrong. That there actually are some benefits. Oh, by the way, you made those gazillions here in this country. And there are some reasons to want to be here.
Yeah.
To those of you who don't want to pay Social Security taxes, we had a caller earlier this week, I just don't want to pay them anymore. Well, there's plenty of countries where there's not insurance for old age. You can go there and not pay the taxes.
Kitts, apparently.
But I imagine you wouldn't want to go there because you like living here. It's the price for living in this society.
Well, I think it's quite interesting. I'm curious what listeners think. Should Mr. Ver be let back in? Could he
pay
just
your
be
old tax
a new,
bill?
Yeah, pay your old tax bill. Otherwise, we're worried that you might become an undocumented illegal.
Right.
So and then apply. Why should we trust you now? It's not like you have a good track record
just
of holding
back here.
Up.
He's going to come back here and apply for welfare and Obamacare. See?
Telling you.
See? Have an anchor baby.
Curious to see what listeners think about that. And there's also another story. It's I think we saw this earlier this week, too, with Democrats announcing a great tax plan, taxes on Wall Street, transaction tax. Yeah. To give middle class and lower income families a tax cut. They've obviously gotten the message that people want more progressive ideas.
Sure.
But they haven't figured out how to tell us about that message.
Well, the means of communication we've talked about over and over again. Mm-hmm. The conservatives have this infrastructure that the progressives don't necessarily have. But they're getting together, though, to work on their bumper stickers, I think.
They are. Nancy Pelosi and Steve Israel have hand-selected a 16-member committee that is designed to broaden their policy and messaging ideas, and essentially not have a repeat of the 2014 elections. However, I'm a little confused. They got the message. We want more progressive ideas.
Right.
We want them to listen to the American people. They've figured that much out.
Yes.
However, I don't know how much more they've figured out beyond that. Because
are they selling the same thing? They just want a better way to say the nonsense?
Right.
How else can you say I'm not like Obama in Kentucky?
Right. There's an article about this over at Politico. Yeah. The party's leadership team was criticized by moderates and younger members post-election as being too fuzzy on their national message and too focused on policy issues like wage disparity for female workers. I don't know that their focus on wage disparity was my primary complaint.
No.
I think they're missing the message on messaging.
Yeah.
It's not, first of all, complaints from moderates and complaints from younger progressive members are probably very different complaints.
Sure.
And
if they had beat the minimum wage instead of saying, I'm pro coal too.
Right.
Those who did talk about progressive ideas won. So let's stick with progressive ideas. And when it comes to messaging, yes, we have an issue with messaging. They have mm-hmm. their Frank Luntzes. People have bantered around like Drew Weston or whatever. If these 16 people can come up with better ways to put across progressive ideas, great. But let's start with progressive ideas and work from there.
Yes.
It'll be interesting to hear what Tom's listeners think of what kind of bumper stickers. When I say bumper stickers, I'm not actually, it's not a bad thing to be. We used to have a board in here, when callers
with
would come
bumper
up
sticker
with
ideas.
Bumper sticker ideas. Messaging is almost as important as the policy itself in terms of getting the people in place to enact that policy.
Right. So, in the about an hour we have left here of hosting for Tom this week, we want to know your ideas for the message. They have 16 people to come up with the ideas, and they're, 16 members of Congress. I'm sure there's staffs and others.
And there's some great people on that list.
Yes. But there's quite a few more listening to this show.
Yeah.
Even despite the fact that we're filling so what are your ideas? And, what are some issues that come up quite often? Minimum wage, racial equality, gender equality, LGBT issues, the environment. It doesn't matter. What are some issues that Democrats can't get the message out on? And what are your ideas for the bumper sticker, for the way to message it? I'm curious. And, of course, all the other topics that we've covered today, anything you want to talk about, and we're still going to talk to Brad Friedman today. So
wow.
We're somehow going to get it all in here. But let's check in first with Mark, listening at TomHartmann.com in San Francisco, California. Mark, you have a comment on Social Security.
I do. Social Security disability. I worked in the printing industry for 37 years, and I put in that money. The Republicans didn't have a penny to put in that, and they don't own it. We own it, the people.
That's right.
And my problem is this. I worked 37 years. I was pushing paper rolls, 700-pound paper rolls downstairs and going up superstructure at all kinds of hours. Sometimes I'd work overtime. Well, I'm 61 years old. I've got a bad back from – I've got some arthritis, and I've got arthritis in my knees. And basically, you know, the wear and tear of that job got to me.
Well, it is a tough job. People don't realize. My family owned a printing company, and the, just the size of those paper rolls, those presses, if you have to move them or shift them an inch, you can do some serious damage and easily wind up on disability.
And, you know, these Republicans that sit there and they basically go to lobbyists, and that's their job. They don't have any kind of blue-collar experience with a job. And they're the ones that are telling us that there's people, you know, with back problems that are faking and all this, you know, that there's all this fraudulence going on. It's a bunch of baloney. These people are out of touch with what's going on in this country. And to me, I am so furious at the Republican Party. And the only way we're going to get anywhere with this issue is to make sure that they got to pay a political price for trying to get their hands on our Social Security. Because the ultimate goal is to say there's fraudulence and then get their hands in it. And start
privatizing. Yep, Mark, right on, my friend. Absolutely.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Thank you very much for sharing your story and for listening over there at TomHartmann.com. Welcome back to the Tom Hartmann Program. Let's go with Norma in Montgomery, Alabama, watching on Free Speech TV. Norma, thanks so much for hanging out with us today.
Oh, thank you for taking my call, Danielle. First of all, I did call Representative Sam Johnson's office, and he's from Texas, and complained about the Social Security thing and asked if I could come live with him when I file bankruptcy and
nice.
Leave my house.
Then what did he say on that? Did he open up his spare bedroom?
Well, of course, I did not get to speak to him. I told his receptionist that if he thinks there's something wrong with Social Security, he can start paying Social Security 100% of his income. But the reason I called was that a lot of people don't understand. I was listening to the guy talking about the Affordable Care Act. I hate people who say Obamacare. It is the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act has a clause in it that limits a health insurance profit to 20% of the premium.
Sometimes 15%, depending on the size of the insurance company.
Right.
Right.
And see, before this clause went into effect, they could take 40 to 60% of your premium as a profit margin. So to maintain that profit margin, they doubled or tripled premiums across the country. Now, when a person has any kind of a tax cut for this premium, we are essentially governmentally subsidizing health insurance companies. And all our lives we have been taught we need health insurance, but nobody needs health insurance. All of us need medical care. There's a difference in the definition of the two terms. But as long as these companies are allowed to increase premiums to maintain a profit margin, people cannot afford health insurance.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent point, and it boils down to the fact that there shouldn't be profit in healthcare.
Right. And in a lot of these cases, these were not-for-profit companies. Technically, what they would do is they take 40 to 60% to pad their own pockets of their executives.
Right. It's wages that they write off.
When it comes to Obamacare, President Obama himself has embraced that term, and I know it's a sticking point for a lot of people. It's considered somehow a pejorative. As this bill and this law becomes more popular, I think that even the Republicans are going to move away from it. Obama's always joked that once it becomes popular, it's not going to be Obamacare anymore.
Right, and you know that's kind of where it stands with me.
And also, you know, in talking when it comes to language, sometimes it's the quickest way and the best way to connect with somebody is so that you understand. It's easier to say Obamacare, but we all understand it is the Affordable Care Act. But it's just, it kind of morphs through time.
Yeah. But Norma, thank you very much. And you make an excellent point about the profit. And that rule in and of itself is doing a lot to keep premiums lower and to keep people getting the health care that they need.
Only have 1 minute.
Only have 1 minute.
Yeah, so we don't have time for another call.
But thank you for watching.
It would be nice to get beyond, you know, a single payer is obviously where we'd like to go. It would be nice to get beyond health insurance companies. Yes. Is this bill perfect? Absolutely not. Would we like to get to a single payer? Yes, we would. Is the path there through Obamacare? Perhaps. Or through the Affordable Care Act, whichever you want to call it? Perhaps.
Hey, there's a messaging question. You know, is there a better way to message health care and single payer than Affordable Care Act or Obamacare? Is there a better way to you know, make people see that there shouldn't be a profit motive in health care? I bet you the people listening have some pretty smart ideas on there. So I'd love to hear it. You're watching the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Shano and me, Danielle, sitting in for Tom today and taking your calls. Let's go to Camden, South Carolina. Is it Callie listening on Netroots Radio? Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Khalil.
Khalil?
Khalil.
Oh, okay.
How you doing? You guys are doing a great job, by the way.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
I'm serious. Tom would be very, he is very happy. I'll put it like that. Okay, so listen, the bumper sticker, the left has almost always been right. You know? Think about it.
I like it. The left has almost always been right.
You can take the almost out. It's kind of long, but
yeah.
The left is always right.
Khalil, just curious, if you find yourself in this predicament too, in talking about political issues and you know, using the terms right and left and right and wrong, I find myself often using the term correct because I don't want to use the term right. Do you find that too?
Yes, absolutely. You don't want to confuse the two because they're so different.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Tom has done entire shows asking the audience, and there's a lot of conservative listeners to his show. I'm sure there's a lot of conservatives right now. Name one major piece of legislation passed by the Republicans in the last 50-100 years that helped working class Americans.
Yes, but I am not Tom, and I do not have the history recollection.
What I'm saying is that bumper sticker is true.
Yeah, it is. The left has always been right.
It is 100% true.
Yeah, excellent suggestion, Khalil. Thank you very much for listening on Netroots Radio there in Camden, South Carolina. Let's talk to Mike watching on Roku in Wilmington, Illinois. Mike, thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Yeah, okay. I just wanted to say that on the messaging thing, maybe people can write things up or type things up and put it on, like, at grocery stores, you know, like on their bulletin board or laundry mats or something like that. You know, I think that would be helpful so other people from all over can read it.
Yeah, you know, we had I don't remember if it was a listener who sent something in. It must have been. But a gentleman sent, it looked like a business card. And I still have it taped up on the wall over there from when they sent it in. And hopefully this person is listening and knows that it left this big of an impact. But it's a business card, looks like a business card, the same size and shape that you would hand anybody when you're handing them their information. But it says, attention business owner, or, you know, I'm paraphrasing, I prefer to shop at stores that support a living wage. And it's just kind of, I think, on the idea that you're talking about, Mike, but where you can walk into any grocery store, any retail establishment, and spread an important political message.
It's like micro-messaging.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
If millions and millions of people micro-message, it can be just as loud, if not louder, grassroots messaging.
Right. You know, and maybe we can't all afford to print up business cards because, you know, it's not expensive.
But we certainly can't afford to buy, you know, segments on Fox News either.
Amen.
So micro-messaging may be the way to go. Doing it, you know, in our conversations with family and friends every single day. But those, like you said, that business card or a piece of paper at a grocery store can have a gigantic impact.
It had an impact on me. I think that person sent
that.
It in probably well over a year ago, and it is still taped up on the wall, and I think
it.
About it all the time.
Yeah.
Let's check in with Donald in Aurora, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Donald, thanks for listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, how you doing? Shano hits the nail right on the head the way he was explaining what the Republican Party, with how they work, their little agendas, and that was beautiful. But you know what really kills me? You don't hear anything like this on national television. I wish this latest this newscast that I just heard, the way the gentleman said it on the newscast, that should be broadcast across the nation. And the truth of the matter is, it's not. You know, if we're going to go down and lose our Social Security, I want to make sure there's a lot of Republican voters that are going to go down with us. And I want them to know that the very people that they put in the office are going to do with Social Security. It's about time they suffer the consequences, too.
Well, Donald,
I'm sick and tired of.
Yeah, Donald, you just said that on national television. You're on Free Speech TV right now, which is broadcast throughout the nation, throughout the world, on Digital Network, DirecTV, and all types of organizations and outlets. But the mainstream, the corporate media, doesn't want you to know that because they want you tuned in to their networks. But Free Speech TV is available in almost every outlet.
This is wonderful. I'm glad to hear that. That makes me feel a lot better. But, you know, we really get I'm starting to worry about that, all these politicians. It seems like all of them, eventually, they all seem to be against the working people. They want to go with the corporations and everything. They're all falling into place. You know, everybody fears these terrorist groups. We have more to fear about our politicians than we have than we do the terrorist groups. They could destroy us without firing a single bullet, and they could do it slowly. And this is what's going to happen if this country and its voters don't wake up to find out the reality that little by little these politicians are not working on our behalf. And I'm surprised President Obama, who I love and voted for him twice, has not mentioned one thing about Social Security.
Yeah,
that does concern me, and I know that a lot of progressives are very concerned that there's not been a peep from the White House that I know of as of this moment of speaking.
Even despite requests for comments.
TPM asked for multiple statements on it, didn't got nothing back. It's an interesting comment, though, that we have more to fear from our politicians, and this is really a result of Citizens United. Period. It all goes back to Citizens United, that the reason that our politicians are serving corporate interests is because the only way they become a successful politician is to get the money from the corporations. Then once they've got to pay them back, and that's the way it is. So when we say that we have more to fear from our politicians being owned by corporations than terrorists, what we really have more to fear from is money in politics.
Yeah. Hey,
there are lots of amazing people out there who are willing to step up and do the public service of governing, of legislating, of being in the executive. There are amazing people in it right now. We need more of them, and the way to get more of them is to getting the money out of the politics, I think.
Amen, Shane. Amen, Donald. Donald, thank you for listening there on WCPT in Aurora. There are people. Maybe we should make a complete ban on, you know, if you've been in Congress, you don't get to go work for a lobbying firm ever. it might solve one of the problems. Just a thought. But there are some
might
great
be
messages. Possibly. You and your darn legal rules.
The real one.
Yeah.
The one we actually want.
There's
read.
Some great messaging ideas on the board. And we're going to speak very quickly with Brad Friedman of the Brad Blog. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
What's your idea for a Democratic message, and how do we get it out there? And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Shano and I are filling in for Tom today. And joining us now is the one, the only, muckraker editor-in-chief Brad Friedman of the Brad Blog and the Bradcast, which you can catch right after this show if you're listening on KPFK. Brad, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, Danielle. Great to talk to you. Happy New Year to you and Shano alike.
Happy New Year to you and Desi. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
In the wake of the Charlie Hebdo attack, there have been numerous viewpoints, questions asked, scenarios considered, and you over at the Brad Blog, as a journalist, as a publisher, as an editor, are asking a question that I don't think I've asked, I've seen asked anywhere else. Can you explain?
Yeah, this started to occur to me last week, and actually I do the broadcast on KPFK on Wednesdays, and the attack, this horrific, barbaric attack at the Charlie Hebdo offices happened just before we went on air last week. And, you know, I immediately started thinking about this and mentioned it briefly on the show, but, you know, kind of wanted to let things settle a bit. I wanted to think about it. I wanted to hear what other people had to say. But we're going to talk about it again on today's show because, you know, in the week that has passed since that terrible attack, the idea has come forward that, you know, not only do we have a right to publish these depictions of Muhammad, and we certainly do, certainly here in the U.S., the freedom of the press does not necessarily apply everywhere else in the world, but it also applies in France. They absolutely had the right to do what they did. The question is, why would they want to? I understood the idea, you know, initially years ago they were responding to the to the attack against the paper in Denmark that had published images of the Prophet Muhammad, and sort of in journalistic solidarity they stood with them and they published them as well. I understand that. I don't like journalist intimidation of any type. Obviously, you know, much less violence and killing over it. That's absolutely, you know, absurd, ridiculous, inexcusable. But my question is, why do publishers feel, when it's not in a newsworthy way or in a way of journalistic solidarity, why do they feel it's okay to publish images that are offensive to a huge group of people? And when I talk about a group of people, I'm not talking about the, you know, the extremists who did that attack and the extremists who would threaten people's lives over this sort of thing. The hell with them. You know, they deserve much of whatever they get. But I'm talking about images that actually offend and blaspheme millions of people in the religion. You know, who are not out there threatening people with violence in response, but who are just offended by this. It seems like it's okay when it comes to, you know, depictions of Muslims and Muhammad. But if the same thing was done against African Americans, against Jews, if there were these grotesque caricatures, I mean, we don't do it. We don't publish grotesque caricatures of Jews, of black people, or at least when we do, or the people that do are shamed for doing so.
Right.
Like,
I don't think
there seems to be a double standard.
I don't think that in this country, in the United States, many of the quote unquote power structure would even stand by quietly and not speak up if there was a blatant attack, the equivalent cartoon about white Christians. I really don't think, I think Fox would, their hair would be on fire. I really honestly believe that, that they would be furiously upset. And in some ways, rightly so, separate from whether or not somebody should be allowed to say that, separate, of course, from whether or not someone deserves to be attacked for it. But I don't understand the why of why we feel it's necessary to attack what someone else believes.
That's exactly it. And this has been getting, you know, I think that my fight for freedom of the press over the 10, 11 years now that I've been publishing the Brad blog is, you know, unquestionable. I believe in freedom of the press in every regard. So I'm not talking about the right to do this. I am talking about why would you want to simply prove that you can? And, you know, to be clear, Charlie Hebdo, as I understand it, it wasn't just, you know, in response to those attacks some years ago, those protests over those Denmark cartoons. It was repeatedly. It was over and over and over again. And I just don't understand why someone would want to. This, we're not talking about going after the terrorists, the extremists. We're not even talking about going after religion in general. If you want to knock that down a peg,
right.
I could understand.
Yeah.
But we're talking about afflicting the afflicted. You know, the Muslim
exactly.
community is a minority in
France. You just hit on something that I tried to get into with John Fugelsang yesterday, and I just completely ran into a break and didn't get into it as well as I would have liked to. But I think that it is vastly different when you talk about that this was the persecuted minority Muslim population in France, if they were the ones making jokes about the broader power structure. I think that there would be a powerful message or could be a powerful message there that is important to a persecuted minority, whomever they may be, expressing and feeling powerful. And I think that's vastly different than a larger population, a predominantly white Christian population, attacking a minority, making jokes about Muhammad, which as much as, some on the right want to make it seem like there's billions of Muslims out there that want to attack everybody. They are a minority and they are harshly persecuted in many of the countries they reside in.
Satire, is meant. There's a reason for satire,
right?
And I'm big. You know, we've run a lot of cartoons over the years. We've done a lot of satire at Brad Blog, even on the Bradcast. I get it. I understand it. I'm in favor of it. I love good satire. But you go after powerful targets. You don't go against the powerless targets. Again, you can. But I just don't understand why anyone would want to. I don't understand what you gain from that. And I know a lot of people will hear this and they may interpret it as, my being some sort of apologist for this horrible behavior. I'm not. I'm trying to ask the bigger question. It's something that we don't allow as a society in other cases. We frown on it when you go against other beleaguered minorities, when you offend them, even if it's for things that a lot of people don't understand why it's offensive. But if the group themselves, if Native Americans feel that this logo, this football team, is offensive, then I don't think it should be done. If Jewish people don't like depictions of, big noses, and I'm Jewish, I don't care for that. I think that it's inappropriate to run it. And I don't think that Fox News and all the other people demanding that, newspapers, AP, New York Times, they must run these illustrations to be in solidarity. I don't think they would be doing that if it was really any other ethnic or cultural group, to be frank.
Yeah, I think we actually have that clip. Shane, do we have that clip? I don't know if I just put Shane on the spot there, but here.
And the correct response to this attack by all of us in journalism, we pretend to be so brave. If we had guts, those cartoons would be reprinted on the front page of the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the LA Times tomorrow. They won't be.
Now, Brad, I have to say, I have followed your work for long before I had the pleasure of becoming what I would call friends with you, speaking to you on various radio programs. And I would say courage is a word that comes to mind when I think of your work. It is one of the first words that come to mind, but yet you don't feel the need to reprint an offensive cartoon. How do you respond to that comment?
It wouldn't be – those same calls would not be made if it was any other ethnic group. We wouldn't be insisting that the New York Times run that character. Of that Jewish pawn shop owner on the front pages to show those Jews that this won't be done. We just would not be doing it. It's the fact that this happens to fit in to something. These are people who already don't like Muslims. And I think that in one respect, they're opportunists and they're using this to basically stoke their own Islamophobia. You can do it. I even support their call to have people do it. I just don't understand why anyone would want to do it. What is accomplished by that? What is accomplished by offending millions of people who have done absolutely nothing to deserve being offended?
Yeah.
That makes no sense to me.
It makes no sense to me either, and it's often a feeling I get hearing some people attack religion as a whole, and especially who do so publicly, who make a point to offend those who have religious beliefs. I see the same ideas, the same methodology of demeaning what people feel and what people believe. I don't get it, Brad, but I do think you are going to have one interesting show on the Bradcast.
Well, I will welcome people's calls on this because I really would like to know what I'm not getting. I'm sure there's something I'm not getting. So since we do believe in freedom of speech, we'll open it up to calls on that very topic.
I am intrigued. Brad, you can check out Brad and hear his response and what other people have to say about it on the Bradcast over on KPFK.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Showing that courage, Mr. Friedman. Thanks so much for your time today.
Always my pleasure, Danielle. Take care.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman program.
You know what that made me think of?
What's that?
I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt right before we get to calls here. That when we do, in this country, there are those cartoons that happen out there. I'm thinking of the offensive, terrible sign that's at some Tea Party rallies of the president's that caricature as the witch doctor. But what our response was, you know, a general populace in shaming, like Brad was talking about.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
I think he'll get some interesting calls.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
We're going to get back to bumper stickers. And
We have a lot of great calls, and I want to get to as many as possible before we run out of time today. Let's check in with Kurt, listening online in Los Angeles. Kurt, I'm betting you have a good idea for a bumper sticker, my friend.
Yeah, I got a bumper sticker, and then I want to follow up on Brad if I can.
Sure, real quick.
First, my bumper sticker, stop funding your own demise. And then give them a link to alecexposed.org.
All right. I love it.
There are hundreds of thousands of corporations that are services unnecessarily and then funneling it through Republican candidates, and they're ruining what our democracy is supposed to be about.
All right. And you had a quick comment on Brad?
Yeah, Brad is right on. I've been trying to call radio talk show hosts all over America telling them, yes, we have the freedom of speech in our country, which is a U.S. Invention of our own constitution. That doesn't mean everyone else in the world, including Muslims, which are billions of them, have to sit there and accept being offended left and right for no good reason. And so if you pop off about someone else's religion, then you need to expect to be retaliated against.
Retaliated against if having maybe somebody criticize your remarks, protest your publication, I think is fine.
A proportionate response.
Right, a proportionate response. I don't think that anybody should have to worry that they're going to be shot or blown up because they publish something that is offensive. I can't accept that.
Right, I don't accept it or believe it either, but it's a reality. You know, we have to understand. It's a reality.
Well, I think the reality is that people will be offended. We often see this when conservatives say something outlandish, people get upset and protest. They claim you're inhibiting their free speech or you don't like their free speech. You have the right to say whatever you want. You don't have the right to expect that people aren't going to get upset about it. But I think in a civilized society, you do have the right to expect that somebody's not going to shoot you over it. I think that isn't too much to ask in a civilized society.
You're absolutely right, but you have to understand we've been dealing with extremists ever since the airlines used to get hijacked back in the 70s. There's always going to be extremists that are going to take guns and take and why would you even want to even go after a segment of a population that has those type of people that
but don't you think the people who want to perpetrate such acts are going to find a reason to? I mean, they're using it.
If you listen, right? But see, the thing is, we never listen to what they're saying. If we listen to what they said, they went to court and tried to ask them politely, stop making cartoons about Muhammad. They went to court.
I don't know that we can say that the 10 people who perpetrated this act were part of that court case. They may have been.
Right.
They very well may
and
have
been. And on
top of
it, there's no cartoon that brought down the World Trade Center.
Right.
So that there's a lot of things going on.
But I certainly agree with the idea that you're not, you know, free of any repercussions at all. People can get mad if you say something that they don't like. That's plain and simple. Thanks for the call, Kurt. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Let's go with Julie in Minneapolis, listening on AM 950. Julie, you have an idea for messaging.
Yeah, I was just going to mention Republicans have lunch, but we have George Lakoff, except that we don't want to listen to him because the moneyed powers that be won't allow it.
Okay.
Too bad.
And have there been ideas from him that you think we should have embraced?
He's written books about messaging.
Right.
It's what he does for a living.
But, I mean, is there a specific one you can name for people listening?
Yeah, I can remember one.
Okay.
So there's this somebody from Texas, somebody like Gohmert, but it wasn't Gohmert, it was somebody else. And he made this really really, really derogatory comments about women. And George Lakoff said that the man should be confronted at that moment with, this man is anti-woman, anti-female, you know?
Right. And it's just, I don't.
Every argument.
Yeah. Perhaps just responding to outlandish statements with a message is in and of itself.
That's something I think that the Democratic Party had picked up on a few election cycles ago. Is this, they've put together these rapid response teams,
yeah,
which I think they're quite good at. So I think that's one of the parts of the messaging is, of course, the timing of it. If your response, and we shouldn't always be responding, I think that's something we're talking about here is actually setting up the conversation, not only responses, but if you're going to respond, the quicker you can respond, the more directly you can respond, the tighter and more concise your language can be in responding, the better off you are. Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you very much for the suggestion, Julie. And remember, by the way, Tom addresses this in a few books, Cracking the Code.
Cracking the Code, yes.
But let's go with Richard. I'm driving through Texas, listening on Sirius. Richard, you have an idea for a bumper sticker?
Hey, Danielle, Shana, how you doing? I'm actually in Wyoming today.
You got to let us know when you truck drivers, when you're changing states, so we can update and tell everybody where you're at today.
We're in Wyoming today. For a bumper sticker, I would say something simple like stop believing what they tell you they did and check the record, and then underneath that, a website listing of, like, Congress. Because I know everything they vote on is a matter of public record, and it's listed on the web.
Yeah.
Tell people, you know, stop listening coming out of their mouth and go online and look at what they actually voted on. Because the Republicans are real good for voting on something and then claiming it was the Democrats that pushed it through.
Oh, yeah. Wait until this Social Security disability thing comes around.
Oh, yeah.
You just wait. It's you can see the train coming in slow motion before it gets there.
Mm-hmm.
You could see it.
Yes. It reminds me of the steamroller in Austin Powers.
Right.
Screaming as it's coming at you. We know it's coming.
We know it's coming.
One of the things I do have to say, though, is finding these voting records, they are a matter of public record, but I kind of know how the process works. Going through these websites is really monumentally difficult.
There's a lot of good websites that do this. And I, you know, in research that we do here for work, I often look into this. Open Secrets is a great one that follows government voting records. GovTrack is another one. There are a lot of great people. I can't imagine what it takes to follow all these votes and put the information down. But there are sites that you can use if you want to see someone's voting record. Let's check in with Anonymous in Woonsocket, South Dakota. You have a comment on, do you have a message for climate change?
There's some stages here in the climate change. I believe we're in stage two right now. Stage one is a CO2 release and the Arctic ice cap diminishing. Stage two is a methane release that's happening right now. The methane is 86 times more powerful than CO2 as a warming agent.
Yes.
In the first 20 years. Stage three is the hydrogen sulfate. And then also at that point, civilization will be falling apart and 440-plus nuclear plants will have meltdowns. And that will sterilize the planet for the future. And that'll be the end of life.
Yeah, Anonymous, is this just to that people need to understand these stages? Is that what you're getting at? I don't mean to cut you off. We only have a minute or so left.
Well, yeah, they need to understand that there's a methane release happening right now in the middle of winter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Lasthours.org actually has
a Arctic
video.
In the Arctic.
Yes.
So imagine how bad it's going to be in the summer.
Yeah, there's a methane cloud actually over a large portion of the United States that is apparently, I think, the size of Delaware or Rhode Island, if I remember the article correctly, but a huge methane release. And as Shane was just saying, that's exactly what Last Hours was about. Anonymous, this is great information. You should certainly put it over on the Tom Hartman Facebook page or Tom Hartman website where people can share it and understand it and, you know, start understanding the way these stages interrelate. But thank you for listening on Sirius.
We have about a minute left.
Okay.
So we should probably not, especially because we're towards the end of the show, and it would be really unfair because we can't come back on the other side of that break.
I know. See, I did plan for a six-hour show. You wouldn't believe the pile I have here of
well,
stuff
got,
that I still want
for tomorrow.
To talk about. Yes.
Tom has it for tomorrow.
Tom will be back tomorrow.
And I'm sure he's going to have 1,000 of his own ideas after being away from his microphone. He's going to be so raring to go. I cannot wait
exactly.
to hear tomorrow's show.
But keep the bumper sticker ideas. You know, you can call and give them to me, and I'll write them down.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'll do with them after
we
that, but we'll figure it out together.
We can make a blog post. Then just start listing them too
exactly.
over at tomhartman.com.
Exactly. So we'll set up a way to share that and keep them coming. It's great stuff. But I wanted to thank all the great guests that have been with us this week. Thanks for helping to make this show happen, as well as the wonderful people right here in the studio who I'm lucky enough to work with, Jim Jabinski, and the Pete, Troy, and Lori, who helped cover the phones. Of course, Sean Taylor, the world's most amazing producer.
Ever.
And Tom and Louise themselves. Thanks to all the stations. And thank you guys for hanging out with us. It's really an honor to hang out with Tom's listeners every day and get to talk to you guys on air. I learn something every second. Thank you.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.